So my name is Kirk Jackson. I'm a security consultant at Aura Information Security.
And I'm Andy Prow. I run Aura Information Security, and it's Kirk's boss. So I'm going to be watching to make sure how he does today. On stage performance review. Always good fun. No pressure.
Great. So what we're going to be talking about today is securing yourself from the top web threats. So yesterday we showed a bunch of threats that OWASP have ranked. They rank them based on how prevalent they are and how disastrous they are. And today we're going to run through the top 11 of the top 10.
We are.
And we've actually got a handout that the first 200 of you, didn't quite expect so many people, can grab from the door up the front at the end. So if you don't want to take notes, or you can download it from our website.
So just a quickie, just for those who weren't here yesterday, everyone know what OWASP stands for? And it doesn't matter if you don't put your hand up, that's absolutely fine. You are allowed not to. So OWASP is the Open Web Application Security Project. So it's an open source group. And if you just check out OWASP.org, Open Web Application Security Project, it's a great resource. They do the OWASP Top 10. It's basically studies on what is out there hacking the internet at the moment. They're a great source of resources, almost as good as us.
And we're giving away a prize at the end, so I just wrote that down as a skill question. So Open Web Application Security Project, if you remember that, you might win a prize. Cool. So today we're going to run through those top 10 things. We're going to show you how to fix them in the application we did yesterday. Do you want to show the application first?
Yeah, sure. So for those who weren't here yesterday, we whopped together a little ASP.NET application. So this was written in .NET 4, SQL Server 2008 database at the back end, running it in IE9. And what we have is a very simple, similar theme as the sort of one days kind of bargain websites. We're just trying to make a business model from a number of those websites out on the internet that will take your money but give you nothing back in return. So that's exactly what Zero Days is all about. In fact, the bargains have all already expired, but it doesn't matter. We still want your credit card details. So you can log in, you can look at what you've already missed out on, and we will still take your credit cards and put it through the online transaction processing. So that's kind of the demo in a nutshell.
Cool. So let's have a look at those top 10 things that we saw. So the first one was SQL injection, and we saw that was quite disastrous, especially if you're running as DBO and your connection string can do all sorts of nasty things. But a basic summary of SQL injection is you're taking some untrusted input from a random user and stuffing it in a SQL statement and letting the database run it. So the canonical kind of example is you've got some user input you're putting into a like clause, percent input percent, and if that input contained a quote, then you could terminate the first statement and then stick another statement in, like drop database or whatever. So that was pretty much the canonical SQL injection example. In our particular example, we had a stored proc that was susceptible to SQL injection. So let's look at what was wrong with that.
So again, just a quick recap. So if you didn't see yesterday, so again, what we did is we SQL injected the search, even though we are using a stored proc. Lots of people say to us, well, that's cool. If you're using a stored proc, you are non-susceptible to SQL injection. Not quite true. You can still write a very SQL injectable stored proc, which is something that Kirk was able to do without even trying. Quite gifted.
I'm quite good at that. Yep.
Oh, just notice my banner ads aren't coming up. But that's all right. We don't need to be online. So what I'll do is if I wanted to go and just search for Lego in our products, that was groovy. And, of course, yesterday when we then added in our quote, which we all remember is our key for SQL injection, things break. So what we're going to do is if we jump back to our stored procedure, what we're doing, the reason it breaks is because we are still putting together dynamic SQL. We are still selecting star from product. We are dumping our search term that you give us from the screen, and we are executing that SQL. So if anyone says you can't have a SQL injectable stored proc, this is exactly what you do. You still dynamically create the SQL inside the stored procedure, run it. It's fully SQL injectable stored procedure.
Yeah, and when we're doing, sometimes we do source code reviews or database reviews. The things we search for are exec, SP, execute SQL, and execute. They're the kind of common flags, and normally people are pretty good at not doing this in stored procs until their stored proc needs to do dynamic kind of ordering. So in some situations, order by first name, last name, whatever, you know, like a sortable grid. And then people just, you know, exec a SQL statement.
And so again, one of the common misconceptions is you say, well, look, it's parameterized. So in my stored proc, I am passing in parameters. Therefore, my search term is parameterized. therefore it won't work. So again, what we need to do is it's still, well, comment that baby out. And what we'll do is if we jump to the correct version that we're going to do instead, or one of the correct ways we could do it, is in essence all we are doing is we are adding our search parameters to the string and passing that in as a real parameter. So we are in fact just using SQL to really parameterize the thing that we should have been doing in the first place. And again, any of this, so if we glance over, we've only got an hour, so if any of this is any questions, do come and see us at the end and we can run through any of these things. Well, look, if I now run exactly the same SQL injectable attack that we had before, again, all it says is no products were found because it's now treating the quote as a real quote character. So if I had Lego quote, Legos,
yeah,
then it would in fact find it. So
what
this is
the
now
plural of Lego?
Well, I guess it would be if it was something owned by Lego, wouldn't it? Eh?
Yeah.
Just remember you were a primary English.
Okay.
Cool. I've looked at your email, so you don't remember your primary English, do you?
Okay, so that was SQL injection. So how do you fix your applications from SQL injection? There's a few different ways, and we'll just quickly go through those for the three technologies that we're talking about. So ASP.NET Web Forms, MVC, and custom SharePoint code. Typically, it's all written the same way. You'd new up a SQL connection object, you'd make a SQL command, you'd check a couple of parameters in. And that's really the key, is to make sure that using SQL parameters and not concatenating strings together, or perhaps using an ORM like Lightspeed or Link2SQL, because they do that for you. The other thing you can do is just review stored procs, like I said. And if you're using SharePoint, actually the advice is to try not to do SQL at all. Like, there's a rich SharePoint object model for selecting lists and items in the list rather than direct database access. And I've seen the SharePoint schema. That's not going to be fun anyway. Cool. So that's your defenses. Our next one was cross-site scripting. So the canonical example for cross-site scripting is where the user's entering something like their first name, but the website is trusting it completely and just blatting it straight out in the HTML. So if the user instead entered script source equals attack at the place where the first name was put out, some JavaScript would run. And so it could be a script tag, it could be an onclick and an href, it could be CSS with the custom IE CSS run JavaScript inside my CSS thing. I can't remember the syntax for that, it's evil. But there's lots of different ways script could get into your site. And there's two basic ways that you fix it. The first and the most important is to block the data on the way into your server. So it's very, very unlikely that someone visiting your website has a script tag as their first name. So don't let them register with a script tag as their first name. Unless Bobby Tables comes along, it's going to be pretty safe. So email addresses, date of birth, all those kind of things that you can regular expression check. But you should also still assume that your database contains malicious data, even if there's only one way into it, which is your website, and encode on the way out. So we'll show you how to do that.
So as you may have seen yesterday if you were here, or if not, as Kirk described. So what I'll do is if we log into our demo site here, and so we were using a Arnie Blunt. So Arnie's able to go down here and leave some comments behind. Looks good, or even look goose.
Beautiful. Look goose. That's look what goose. Pirates say. Looks
arg. So what are we going to do? So we're going to come in here, and again, what we're able to do is just post normal comments, but of course, we're able to, you know, talk like a pirate. Arrgh. So if we come in here and just pop that in here. So of course, as you would have seen yesterday, all this is doing is in fact our comment now contains the script tag. Beautiful. So when we leave behind our comment, someone else who comes along to this page actually runs our script on this page. So this is script XSS, cross-site scripting. So script injection 101. So our comment now contains the script. You don't see it on the page. But every time anyone, it's not just us, anytime anyone comes to the page, our script runs. Now, of course, as Kirk said, it's not just from here. So as we had a bit of carnage yesterday on the Rugby World Cup. So what we've got here, here we go. Okay, so Steve Jobs, no longer detective. Who's handing your Mac? No.
So, So as you remember, we crowdsourced our cross-site scripting yesterday.
Oh, man.
And we were quite happy that no one used profanity or directed us to porn sites or anything. So thank you very much for controlling yourselves.
So the point about this, those who missed yesterday. So what have we got? So we were actually completely flooded by scripted tweets. So again, if you jump into Twitter and you write yourself a tweet, hi Andy, script, blah, 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 blah. So what will happen if you then review your tweet, and if you look at most of the other Twitter apps, you will just see the script as text. However, that's because Twitter sanitized, so they'll just store it at the back end as the raw script that you type in. To protect themselves against cross-site scripting, they will sanitize it on the way out so it looks beautiful on their own sites and their own products. However, if you just plug in, so this was a standard, we went searching, I can't remember if it was like a code project or somewhere.
I think I copied code from somewhere.
Yep. Yeah, so we just did as a standard devs or as lazy devs like Kirk, we just went, oh yeah, that seems to work, boff, plug it in. And what it does, it just goes to the Twitter feeds and it just searches and we'll come back with our hashtag and it will just give us whatever's in the back-end database, which contains script. So when we stick it up on our page, your tweet containing script runs a script on our page. Bugger. So yesterday we did have a bit of a crowd fest with a number of tweets coming in that, of course, almost broke things. I was really happy that we didn't have any that were like doing a changing the URL location of where we were and sending us somewhere else or embedding iframes that contain dodgy images. So at least it was just alert boxes.
Yep.
But now I've told them to do something else, we'll probably get some funny tweets coming through.
Right? Don't reload this page. No.
So anyway, it's a really good point, eh? So this is the last time we're going to refresh this page at all. So, and the key thing is this is not just what we've saved in our database. This is everything we're getting through banner ads, through tweets, any other components that you're getting text that's going to be rendered onto your page. Absolutely sanitize it for all of those tags you really don't want to see. So that's cool. We also showed yesterday, so this is a form of persistent. That's what we saved in the Lego. We've got feeds coming in from Twitter. If we go and just search again, so we've also got the reflected. So reflected is when we can search down here for a search parameter. That's cool. These are all our bargains containing A. We can alternatively, if I happen to have found you a nice, turn that off again. Maybe I found a good bargain, and what I'll do is say, oh, hey, look, you should go and look for all of the bargains on rugby. That's cool. And so what that will do is that will just auto-populate the search for us. Now, one of the things that we're doing incorrectly is whatever search term you put on the URL, we're searching for it, and then we're telling you what we just searched for. So whatever's in our input query string, we take it, we use it, we stick it straight back on the page. So this is where you're completely vulnerable to reflected XSS. Okay, so, and sorry for those who saw this, so we'll be testing at the end to make sure you do remember. So what happens here, I put it through reflected XSS. So it does the search, it can't find any products containing reflected XSS. I searched for Lego. As you see, I can't see the script here because it ran on the page. So again, this is great. I send out a blanket amount of emails. Hey guys, look at these new bargains. But as soon as you view it, the page you're viewing scripts you. So.
Yeah, and before Andy fixes that, yesterday we showed how cross-site scripting can be weaponized. So you know, someone can sit in a different country, record what you're doing on a browser, get the content out of your browser, get the contents of your clipboard as you're using other applications on your computer, and so on. So XSS is a big issue. And we see it in most applications we review,
I'd say. Yeah. Either persistent or reflected or both, or in from other feeds. So there are ways to protect, fortunately. So the one that we're just going to show the usage of is in our Microsoft, using the Microsoft Anti-XSS Library. So what we're going to do here is we are assuming, so this is in our Twitter control. Before, the label, the text that we were going to send up is basically, so we do our search, so we'll have our, somewhere up here will be our Twitter feed, yada, 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 it's got the URL in it somewhere else. But basically what happens is we come back, and the text we're going to display on the screen is literally whatever Twitter returns to us. So what we're going to do, we're going to assume that's unsafe, and in fact we're going to use the anti-XSS HTML encode. So if we straight away look at that one and jump back into our rugby.
Yeah. Hopefully this works.
And what we would now hope is that nothing appears on our page, but what we can see is the actual script that people have put in. So again, this is what Twitter do on their own page, and this is what you'll see. So this is what everyone's actually put in as their comments. So sanitized on the way out. Similar deal. So if we look at everywhere else, when you add a comment, so again, the comment that we put in before to talk like a pirate, And if we also have a look at our other location, which is in our search page, so where we have reflected XSS, same again, we just take our query string search parameter, Groovy, and we'll just stick that straight back up on the page. Again, everywhere that MPAT's coming through, in this scenario, we'll just use the anti-XSS. And so we'll describe some more of the additional features of the anti-XSS in a moment. But if we just run through these.
One of the reasons why it's really hard as a developer to eradicate cross-site scripting from your site is you have to think of everywhere that input could possibly have come from. So query string parameters, that's kind of an obvious one. You can do a search, find in files for all the query string parameters, make sure they're encoded. But, you know, data ends up on the page from so many different sources. It's quite a burden to figure out where everything's come from. Does it need encoding or not? And web forms makes it more difficult than it should as well. So we'll talk about that when I get to the slide.
But really one of the messages has to be trust nothing from anywhere. So as a web dev, trust nothing that's in your database. Trust nothing that's come from the input parameters that you've given your users. Trust nothing from any other provider. Assume that everything will contain all of those nasty things that shouldn't be there. And again, if we have a look at this one, we can actually see what the anti-XSS library is starting to do. So as you can see here, it's actually encoded all of those tags.
Less than, greater than.
Correct. That it thinks are malicious. But the way that the XSS library works is instead of you can use blacklisting, where it's going to hunt for all of the bad things that could be there, it might hunt for angle brackets. Instead, it works on a whitelisting that says, right, if it's a normal text, I like it. Otherwise, I will encode everything else. So it's all-inclusive. And as we can see, when we actually render it as the HTML, we get to see what the person put in. Oh, I can see it on my page, though. Look.
Okay, as he can
when
see.
I look in, yeah, okay, cool.
So how do you do this in MVC, Web Forms and SharePoint? Oh, or instead, let's talk about this slide. So one of the things that burdens you as a developer is you actually have to know what kind of encoding to do for different situations. So HTML encode, you've probably all used HTTP utility.html encode, but that only works when the content is in HTML, so inside a paragraph tag or a div or whatever. You have to use other kind of encoding if it's in different places. So, for example, if you're outputting some script tags with some variables in them, then you have to use a JavaScript encoding there because the single quote is a special character. And actually, single quote and a closed script tag will escape out of that. So it's kind of annoying. If you've got a URL, then you have to use a URL context encoding. If you've got an attribute like a class tag or a style tag, you have to use another kind of encoding. And it depends where on the page the data is showing. So you can't really do it, the encoding in your business layer when you grab stuff from the database. You have to do it close to your view because that's where you know how you're going to output the data. So there's three different technologies that all have different ways of doing it. As I was saying before, ASP.NET Web Forms, there is a lot more burden on you. And that's because a lot of the older controls like label and some of the other sort of ASP.NET 1 controls don't do any encoding, or they'll do encoding on some parameters but not on other parameters when you set values on your controls. So if you take data from the database and put it in the CSS class parameter of one of those controls, it won't encode it, but if you put it in the text parameter, it will. So it's quite a big burden on you as a developer, and actually it's one of the reasons why I don't do web forms anymore when I do projects. So the two ways we suggest are to encode all over the place. The anti-XSS library is functionally equivalent to HTTP utility, but it's written in a safer way. Or this security runtime engine. And what you do there is you plug it into your web config, and after the page is assembled, it walks through the control tree of your page, so you know it's got the body with everything inside it. And it goes through every label, text box, and encodes everything that needs encoding. So it's kind of like a safety net if you use that security runtime engine. For MVC, the new Razor views, which you've probably seen this week somewhere else, it encodes your content by default when you output it using that at and the variable name syntax. And you have to explicitly opt in to not encoding your output. So that's much better than web forms. You know, it's encoded by default. MVC, was it 2? Included new syntax for outputting in regular web form views, which was this angle bracket percent colon, which is like an equal turned on its side, as Scott Hanselman says. And that encodes when you use that syntax, but if you use percent equal, it wouldn't encode. So that's also something that you can grep for. You can search through your web form views and make sure you don't use percent equal anywhere in your views. SharePoint has a really good class called SPHTTP Utility. It's like HTTP Utility on steroids. It does encoding, but it also does HTML neutering as well. So if you want some tags to come through from your database, I guess SharePoint, from your lists, and put them out on the page but not other HTML tags, then they have some methods in there that can be helpful. Cool. The next in the top 10 is broken auth and session management. And we see this occasionally. It's normally when people roll their own. So we don't see it so often in Microsoft land because the built-in ones are pretty good. Session IDs that ASP.NET dishes out are pretty cryptographically strong. If you do a statistical analysis on them, they're randomly distributed. It's very hard to predict what a person's session ID is going to be and grab their session. And also the Forms Auth cookies are pretty good as well. They use encryption. But if you're using another platform like PHP or an old Java servlet container, then their session IDs are rubbish. So you really need to make sure that your session cookies are good. One thing that we do see a lot of in ASP.NET applications is that second point, not enforcing logout on the server side. So the scenario here is someone's using your website, they've logged in, they've bought some products, they click the logout button, and they walk away from the computer. Most ASP.NET apps, when you click the logout button, all they do is tell the browser to forget the cookie. So if an attacker manages to get that cookie, they can keep using the site as the user. And I'd venture to say that all of the apps we've built, that behavior happens. So what you need to do is store something on the server that says, these are the active sessions, these are the active Forms Auth cookies, and then as you log out the user and say, forget that cookie, invalidate that in your backend database or wherever you're storing the active sessions so that the cookies can't be captured and reused later on. Another thing that we recommend people do is to set the two flags on cookies that protect them. So when a cookie is generated by a server, the browser remembers it and it exposes it to JavaScript, and it will send it to any website that has the same URL as the cookie was issued from. So that doesn't matter if you issued it from an HTTPS website, it'll send it to an HTTP website. So say you've logged into an online banking site, the whole site is over HTTPS. But if an attacker is controlling your internet connection, say you're on public Wi-Fi, they can trick you to going to an HTTP version of the bank's website, and they'll be able to sniff that cookie as it goes past. So that's the secure flag. The HTTP only flag that says to JavaScript, don't touch my cookies, and most of the new browsers enforce that. I think we'll demo how to turn that on in ASP.NET.
Yep.
Two other things. Username and password brute force. So this is when on the login page you make sure that one user doesn't try and log in more than 5 times with invalid passwords or you suspend their account for 30 minutes. That's password brute force. We see that a lot. Username brute force we don't see as often. Sorry, brute force protection we don't see as often because the scenario there is an attacker is going to a site with a lot of users. So say a Trade Me or that's basically the only website in New Zealand with lots of users. So say, Trade Me. And they know that probably 1% of users use the password of password, lowercase. So they just try every username with the password password. And most people don't defend against that because it's kind of harder. You need to sort of keep track of, for a given IP address, how many login attempts have they done and log like that. And the last point, something that's very important is if security events are happening on your system that you don't intend to happen, make sure that someone knows about it. So we've all got these nlog text files somewhere on our web server. No one ever reads them, but make sure that there's some way to alert to sysadmins that you've detected brute force or that someone's fiddling around with their cookies so that if you detect a trend, you can investigate manually. So let's do a demo of just how to do the cookies in ASP.NET.
Cookies in ASP.NET. So what we've got here is if I fire up the web config, there's several settings which it lets us put in here by default. We which often are there. So if we have a look at this, HTTP cookies. So what have we got here? We're saying that we want HTTP only cookies.
So that means not accessible from JavaScript?
Absolutely. So if we get time at the end, or for those who remember yesterday, when we fired up our XSS shell, so remember this was the weaponized cross-site scripting. So the point of the weaponized cross-site scripting is that it's not just me popping up alert boxes, it's not just your tweets going hi, you redirecting me to somewhere else, stuck in the iframe with root pictures. Instead, it's you actually be able to control the script that's running in my browser. One of the things we could do, if you remember, Kurt kept saying, is there something you want me to do? Something you want me to do as a compromised browser? One of the things we could do is say, yes, give me back your session cookies. That's exactly the kind of thing that through JavaScript would be unable to be happening if we had HTTP only. Requiring SSL, so again, exactly as it says. And what we'll do is we copy around exactly that same require SSL, and I will actually leave these as false afterwards because otherwise our website kind of breaks quite quickly because it goes, no, you just told me to use SSL and I'm not. So demo only, but remind me not to save this and then rerun.
So so something you want to do is in your release process, use those custom flaggy things you can do in your web config so that when you're devving HTTP only, when you're devving it can work over HTTP, but when you go to your UAT or your live, you set those SSL flags.
And so the key thing that I have, obviously you can enforce an IIS whether or not you can use SSL, but this will just really then also say, am I allowed to have my session cookies and tokens also over a non-SSL connection?
Cool.
Easy. See? That was quite easy to do.
Oops. Went the wrong direction. Cool. So the... I've already shown that slide, eh?
No, back to you. You're on me.
Oh. Apologies.
There you go.
Technology. We don't have one of these in my office. Okay.
Is it? Would you like one?
So we've said all that stuff. So the next one to talk about is insecure direct object references. And this is just a mental name for a risk. And no one knows what it means. But basically, you know what this means. It's when you have a URL on your website where you take a document ID, like the number 7. It's my lucky number. And only certain users can see that document. So in your code, you go, you know, if the user was the author or the user is an administrator, then show the document, otherwise don't. And insecure direct object references happen when you don't enforce that in your code. And you assume that if people can't guess the URLs, then they won't be able to access it. So, yeah, so another one is when you're dropping stuff into a directory on your server, like a customer 7 directory for the customer number 7, dropping some files with predictable names in there. If customer 3 notices that the URL looks predictable, they might try iterating through them. It's a very common kind of attack. So how do you fix that? Well, basically you do it in code most of the time, especially if you're getting down to is the user an author. But you can also do things like in your web config, require that all users going to a certain subdirectory of your web form site are admins. In MVC, it's slightly different because your web config way doesn't work as well. So you have to decorate the actions on your controller with what roles can perform those actions, or even inside the actions, do that same custom logic. SharePoint has a slightly nicer way of doing it where you can configure who can access lists. So if you're writing custom code to get lists out of SharePoint and display them, then you can use this securable object class to check that the user has permissions to the list. Or you can actually use check permissions, which just throws an exception if they don't have access to the list. But basically, it's effectively the same protection for all three, just different syntax. Cool, the next one's cross-site request forgery. So this comes under lots of names, CSERF, XSRF, one-click attack, session writing. And it's basically the scenario we had Bevan sitting at the table, sitting on a chair here. He did a great job sitting there. He actually got favourable reviews in the session evals. So
yes, he did. Didn't they actually say that he was one of the best presenters on stage?
Yeah, they did.
Pretty good.
He only said about 3 things. Doesn't
exactly.
Really. Anyway, so cross-site request forgery is the scenario when the user has the ability to do something. So I'm a valid user. I can post data to the web server. An attacker assembles that same post data, and when I visit his website, he tricks me to post that data to the web server. That's cross-site request forgery. So it could be I'm allowed to delete users in the intranet, I'm allowed to change bank account numbers, I'm allowed to change pay levels in an HR system because I'm an administrator, and then when I go to the attacker's site, he tricks me into posting that data to the server. The way that we fix this normally is to use a CSRF token, which is some information that the attacker does not know. So in that post data that I have to give to the web server, there's something secret in there that the attacker has no way of knowing. And it can't be a cookie, because when I go to his site and post, my browser will automatically pass along the cookies. So the way we normally do it is a hidden form field. And that means that the attacker can't assemble the same post data anymore. So we'll just give a quick demo of how you turn this on in web forms. It's really, really easy.
Really easy. So, again, so just for the benefit from yesterday, as a quick reminder. So, for instance, if we go to our Rugby World Cup, which now fortunately has 20 neutered tweets, because it got a little noisy here yesterday before we actually fixed these up. So if you remember what we can do, so we are currently logged in as Mr. Arnie Blunt. And if you remember, what we can do down here is leave some comments. So I can just kind of, you know, leave another comment. And so what that will do, save that at the back end. Absolutely fine. But as you saw, to leave a comment, I had to physically type text. Now, with the cross-site request forgery, what we did is we went to view Evil Days profile. We can see that Mr. Evil Days has an evil homepage. And we're going to have a look at it. This is Evil Days homepage. Nothing to see here. The site's been shut down. Okay. No, fair enough. So again, we're not worried. It's just an HTML page. So we jump back to our Rugby World Cup site. And one of the things that we notice is just by coming past here, we have just left. Wow, I love this product. Woohoo! Definitely recommend. And we just left that literally just now. So this was our cross-site request forgery payload from yesterday. In essence, what we've done, we have recorded what a post looks like to post feedback. We actually had another one we rolled in yesterday that would actually add the product to the basket. We could have then maybe taken you to the checkout. So the point is, we have, as a targeted attack, pre-recorded what that looks like, as Kirk says. So, and as an attacker here, so for instance, this was Arnie Blunt. But in fact, if we don't do any protection against it, so this is me over here in Firefox, I'm now in as Barney Rubble. Completely different user.
Hey, Fred.
So if I actually mosey in...
Can't remember what else he said.
I think Barney said it. No, I think Hey, Fred was pretty much all he ever said. So if we now view Evil Days homepage, a similar deal. We've come as a different user from a completely different browser, different web session. Everything else is different. And interestingly enough, we're no longer logged in Firefox.
Oops.
Do you like that bit of the demo? So what we're just demonstrating there is that Firefox has this session timeout feature.
I think it's our FormsAuth cookie, actually.
Yeah, it could be, man.
We did that more than half an hour ago.
So imagine that it hadn't just logged me out as I did it. And imagine that instead, as Barney Rubble, I had just gone to look at Evil Days.
So this homepage is on a different server or whatever. So some other place.
So now, hopefully a little more successfully than 15 seconds ago, is that Barney Rubble also loves this product. Barney Rubble would have also have just stuck it into his shopping basket. Barney Rubble's also going to do like it. So he's going to do everything else. So again, doesn't matter where we are, because we've constructed it, we can post back exactly the same through anyone's active session.
So all that's sitting on that malicious website is a form tag with a bunch of hidden input fields. It's got the button field, it's got the view state field, all the other fields sitting there.
That's right.
And then it just submits it with JavaScript. And you can't see it because it's in a hidden iframe.
So that was our hidden iframe. If we jump back to one of our variants, this is exactly all we've done. We have pre-recorded what that form post is going to look like. And as Kirk said, everything remains static each time except for the current ASP.NET session tokens, which he's already got live in his browser because he's already gone to the site that I'm attacking.
Yep. So this kind of attack is typically a targeted sort of attack. Although I guess Facebook, everyone's logged into that all day, every day at work, so you don't have to target too much. But normally if you're going against an intranet or something like that, you're looking for people who are already logged into that system.
But
and
it is
tricking them into doing
it's definitely
something.
Targeted that you have to target, or you are targeting the end. So it is a Facebook particular one. It could be one for one of the banking sites. So we have to have gone there before. So what we're going to do to protect it, that one liner. So So we are setting, this is in our base page. So we're setting a view state user key to something unique. In this case, we're just going to be using our session ID.
Yeah, so the kind of the good thing about this is in web forms, it's really easy. It's a one-liner. The bad thing about this is you have to do it in your on-init part of your page processing, which is before view state is loaded, which is why you have to set this user key first. And what was the other thing? Oh, you have to have a base page. That's right. So if you've got a page with 3,000, a site with 3,000 pages and no base class, you either have to copy that code into every page or you have to have a base class they all inherit from. But it is built in.
So we had the last post from Barney at 12:29. We've only got one post from Barney. With that one change, we would hopefully assume that now the same post has been sent from our attacker's page. It didn't change in any way. But unfortunately, the post was unsuccessful. And the reason being is because we've now, as Kirk will describe, adding in that view state user key just changes how the server is going to authenticate the requests coming through.
Yeah, so this is effectively adding an extra thing as a hidden field on our forms. Because the view state's already this huge blob, but you can put extra data in it. And I've got a slide that shows kind of how it works in web forms. I'll just jump forward to that while I'm talking about it. So view state, it's evil and nasty, but it's a blob of binary stuff on the top left there. I'll wiggle my mouse so you can see where I'm pointing at. So view state is a blob of binary data. What the server does is it uses a MAC key to generate a hash value. When the browser sends the view state back, it runs that hash again and checks that the key matches. So that's the standard MAC view state functionality. If you add a user key as well, it uses the user key as well as the MAC key. And the user key might be the user's session ID, their username, or something else that an attacker doesn't know what it's going to generate. So now it's got the MAC and the user key. When the view state gets hashed, gets sent to the browser sends it back on the next post. When it gets deserialized, it checks the hash again, and because the user key matches, the hash will match. So that's hopefully that made that clear. Otherwise, you can look at that link later on. So ASP.NET, you could also do it with a form tag, a hidden field if you wanted, but since there's an out-of-the-box way to do it, that's what I'd recommend. For MVC, it was in the Futures Assembly, and now I think it's in MVC. It's been in for a while. There's this anti-forgery token, which you can put that in every form on your website. So after every form that you output, you have to add that token in. So that's kind of lame, but you have to opt into it. Or you can write a bit of code that instead of adding a form the Microsoft way, you call your code, which does those two steps. And this anti-forgery token actually sets a cookie, so that sits in the user's browser with some random blob, and then puts the same thing in the hidden field. So an attacker, when they try and trick you into doing something, they won't know what that hidden field is that should match the cookie. So that works. And then each action, you actually have to go and put that token on it, validate anti-forgery token, so every action and every controller. Kind of lame. There's examples of how to do it on a site-wide basis when you Google for it, but nothing out of the box. SharePoint has a pretty similar kind of setup. Every request needs to have this form digest field, and all of the built-in SharePoint functionality has it. If you're building any of your own code in SharePoint, you have to make sure that any data you post to your own code also includes a form digest field and that you call validate form digest in your own code. So there's examples for that on Google as well if you go for a search for it. So things like AJAX requests, basically anything where you do an update in SharePoint to SharePoint data, you need to be doing that. Some links there that'll hopefully help you find that. Cool, so security misconfiguration. This is like number 2, 4, 5, 6. Sixth most bad thing. So we see a few of these things. When we're doing reviews, we often see old versions of Linux, old versions of Windows. There's not really any excuse not to have Windows Update running on your web server. Patch Tuesday comes around. You should get those patches up as quick as possible. Make sure everything's up to date. And there's software that you can install on in your environment to alert you when software is getting out of date. There's external scans. We've got a software product called RedEye, which scans your network and sends you an alert if you've got software that's out of date.
Yep.
Other things you've got to do is close all the ports you don't need, uninstall all the software that you don't use, disable it. So out of the box, these days, most Microsoft products come with the least amount of stuff configured, and you have to go and enable all of it. But some products aren't as good as that, and you know, you'll install the product, and it's got all these things open that you have to go and turn off to make it secure. And there's a bunch of best practice analyzer tools for SQL Server, IIS, and other Microsoft products that will just check you've locked stuff down.
And again, what's quite key is that on the web app, it's not just the underlying OS and the web app itself, but you also need to look at all the other third-party apps that you're plugging in. So whether or not you're using Telerik controls, if you're using a blog, if you're using an ad server, whatever else it might be, is that you might keep your server fully patched, but if you don't keep all of the other bits patched as well, then new and emerging threats will start hacking them. And it doesn't matter which way the attacker gets in, they're still going to compromise your web server.
Yeah, so quite a good idea as a developer is to log into your marketing website for your company. Oh, not login, probably not. Open marketing website with Firebug open or Fiddler running and just see which external services get loaded via JavaScript. You'll be surprised what marketing will sneak into your marketing website. There'll be, you know, ads or tracking and things like that. And just think about what happens if those software products are out of date or vulnerable. And the last point there is encrypting sensitive info. So that web config file sits in your web server's home directory. And IIS stops it being served. Yesterday we showed how you could copy it using SQL injection. But you really don't want anything sensitive in your web config. It's sitting on a web server. It should be encrypted. So that's database connection strings, keys for PayPal APIs, or you know, anything that an attacker could take and make money out of or cause embarrassment should be encrypted. So we'll just do a demo of how to do that. It's really simple.
So what we're going to do is, if we put together two of our attacks, so I've undone the protection against our SQL injection, and in fact I'm just going to do it on our search page. So here I'm actually going to do, and for you guys yesterday, what we've done is we actually had the XP command shell disabled on SQL 2008 R2. However, because we are connecting through as DBO, because that was the simplest thing to do to get the website running. So we just created a database user, connection string, run as DBO. It means that through SQL we can enable things like XP command shell. So again, if you're not familiar with those, just let us know at the end and we can have a chat. But the XP command shell lets you run things. So what I'm actually going to do is just run a search. My search is going to request that behind the scenes my web server copies the web config and sticks another copy of it out there on my own web server for me to browse. So exactly as Kirk said just then, we'll run this kind of query. We'll do a little search where my search is. And we'll just grab just that bit there. Let's search for again. HP. We'll just paste in the rest of that. Bing. Cool. So what has that search done? That search query that I put on the URL that I sent to your website asked your search page to do the SQL injection to copy your web config to webconfig2.txt. Why did I even bother doing that? There's a copy I happened to prepare earlier. It's because you happen to have a plain text string that contains...
Smoke. Oh, look, it's mirrors.
Essay. Welcome, hackers. But it's not smoke and mirrors. It's all real juju.
You actually did do that just then. Yeah.
I can copy it to a different file if you want to see it.
They don't want to see that.
Okay, no good.
Cool.
So, but what we can do, so if you guys, and this will be one of the bits that I'm sure many of you will be able to remember this off the cuff. So we can use ASP.NET Reg IIS. We're actually going to encrypt the connection string section. The reason we're going to do that, a very common flaw, and if we run back to the query that we did just a second ago, but this time we want to save it out to webconfig3.txt, for instance. Beautiful.
Now we'll see.
Now. Poof. And instead what we've now done is those SA welcome hackers are indeed now the encrypted strings. So this is the reason why when you see things like ASP.NET Reg IIS to encrypt things in your webconfig, you're kind of going, why would I bother? It's because you happen to have reflected XSS, which also lets you do reflected SQL injection that you haven't picked up in the stored proc that you put in the database that will let you copy the web config to your web server. So this is why you would do that kind of thing. And this is where chaining of attacks gets quite dangerous. This is, in essence, three things that we've done wrong here. We didn't protect our web config properly. We didn't protect against SQL injection. We've also got some reflected XSS, so another mechanism to get it up on our screen. A number of kind of security.
So that Reg IIS tool, it's got a few different ways of encrypting and different places to store your web config. So just read the documentation. It's not that nice documentation, but read that documentation. The other thing we should configure on our server is to disable those error messages.
It's a good point. So what we had a minute ago is when we did our first when we first got in to do any form of SQL injection. One of the things it did is use the search that was on my query string by default.
Who writes a website like that?
That's crazy, man. So again, so what happened is that, as we showed yesterday, because we're not doing any proper error handling, we're telling the attacker exactly why stuff's breaking, what the SQL error was, we're showing them the stack trace of what goes wrong. And so again, as well as not releasing debug code.
It's really funny when you go to like an airline booking website or something like that, and you see their source code, and you go, man, that's ugly source code in the error message. So from a developer point of view, we need to turn this off just for our own pride.
Absolutely so. And again, it's nothing to do with security. It's purely developer pride. I see. This is why you wrote such bad code. So if we come here, so exactly the same. So what will happen is we haven't actually fixed our SQL injection, but at least we've stopped you seeing what the error was. Now, unfortunately, this does leave us open to what we call blind SQL injection. And so what happened in blind SQL injection, won't go in detail, but instead of just seeing what errors come on the screen, I would also put a delay in there. So I'm going to try something on your website with a delay. If your error page takes a second to come back, I know my thing worked. And if it returned instantly, I know it failed. So it's more of a Boolean try and fail with blind SQL injection. I'll run 10,000 queries, and I'll see spikes at each one that worked because it took a second to return. So it doesn't matter if you handle the errors. If you're still vulnerable to SQL injection, you're buggered. But this just shows how to protect those.
So just switch back to the code that you changed in webconfig.
You wanted to see that?
Yeah, so all you need to do is turn on custom errors and then give a redirect to a page. You've all done this, I'm sure. The thing that we often forget to do is in dev, we turn it off. We check in when we go live, it's still turned off. So just remember, as part of that release of your web config, to have sort of conditional build. Cool. So the next thing is about crypto. Two things about crypto stuff, I guess. There's crypto over the wire, so SSL, and there's also storing stuff in a secure way. And unfortunately, the most common bad thing that people do is to store the plain text of a password in a database. And it always makes me cringe when I receive an email from some website after I've forgotten my password, and they say, "Sorry, Kirk, you forgot your password. Here it is, Kirk."
Fluffy duck.
Why have they stored my password in their database? Now I'm going to have to change it everywhere. Of course, you never do that. But so what you should be doing is only storing a hash of a password. So I recommend Googling that if you're not doing that and learning more about that. The other thing to think about is what sensitive data is in your system and is it encrypted in every place that it lives? So it might be encrypted while it's in your database, but are the backups encrypted when it goes out to a storage facility and someone compromises the tapes? Sounds weird. Are they going to get any data is a question?
Yeah. Salting the hash?
Yes.
Good man. I think we'll give him a bonus.
No, when we get to the thing,
when we do the,
he'll get a free life at the end.
Oh, really? Yep. Free life, exactly. Cool. That's what I was meaning.
If you've got credit card data, then follow PCI standards or avoid it if you can. And also, depending on your jurisdiction that your application's run in, personally identifiable information, health data, there could be laws that apply to how you have to encrypt your data. And the main thing here is, don't invent the crypto yourself. Use something that's out of the box, preferably out of the Microsoft box, not off a Code Project website. I've seen code on Code Project, which is the simple way to do encryption, And the simple way to do encryption is they hard code a bunch of stuff to really dumb defaults. Yep. So do it properly.
We've seen static keys so that every time you encrypted, so it basically said, here's crypto, but it's so easy, you don't even need to provide the IV, initialization vector, you don't have to provide the key or the password, passphrase for it. It's just crypto 101, and you just run this crypto DLL. In essence, it just used the same key for every encryption and decryption. We've also seen another one that used base64 encoding. So you'd actually go to encrypt, and it would come up with a base64 encoded string. Look at that and go, well, it's not what I put in, so it must be encrypted in some way.
Base64
encoding? So just for those who, so base64 encoding and encryption are two slightly different concepts.
Cool.
And if you're running a website, it's good to remember.
Yeah, we'll try not to talk too much about crypto because that's a whole talk. But yeah. I did want to mention this Debian thing that happened. So I think it was from 2006 till 2008. Any SSL certificates or CA certs that were generated on a Debian system were predictable. Nobody noticed for almost 2 years. And that was because one of the Debian maintainers got an error in their code analysis tool, and they fixed it, checked in the fix for the Debian-specific version of OpenSSL, and nobody noticed. And there's this really cool Dilbert cartoon that fit in this talk right here, but it costs $60 US to put a Dilbert cartoon on the screen, so fair use lets me put 10% of that. So
that's fair enough.
So go to that URL, and you can see the whole cartoon.
Exactly so. That's yeah. So each time he goes back, there'll be a different year.
Yeah. And, you know, you might laugh, but these kind of things happen all the time. PHP this week, they released a new version of PHP and then said to everyone, don't use our new version of PHP. Please don't use it. Because some guy went, oh, the strcat function, that's not very good. My code tool says that's bad. They replaced it with stralcat and left the same arguments. Those two functions do slightly different things. And that meant that every MD5 sum that got created with a salt just returned the salt. So that was really, really bad. So crypto, avoid, use the defaults, don't write it yourself. This failure to restrict URL access, it's very similar to the insecure direct object reference. This is just about if your site has two sections, a public section and an admin section, why would you put the admin section on the internet? There's no reason to. Put it inside your corporate intranet. Make people VPN in to access that. And you've just got like a whole range of problems you don't even have to think about as a developer because, you know, people can't elevate privileges. So I said that quite strongly. It's often not so cut and dried, but consider it at least. The other thing to think about is not putting source control files on your web server. So don't just copy your dev directory and put it up on the web server. Guy Pipes from Wellington, he wrote a tool that would go to web servers and search for Git and SVN repositories, so you know, www.twitter.com/.git. And then by predicting the file names, he was actually able to build up the source control for these websites, so the source code for those websites, because there was enough information in those distributed source control systems to actually extract the source code. So that was probably pretty embarrassing for whoever's sites he found that on.
We've also found, indeed, full database backups, and one of the juiciest ones was a customer who had uploaded the whole certs required and the passwords to actually install them on the box as well as a small sort of update script. So, again...
And there's tools. So the tools that crawl over a website looking for security vulnerabilities, they'll try commonly known directory names, commonly known file names, and try and get stuff. So the version of Drupal that you're running is very useful if you're going to run a Drupal-based attack. So don't leave the version .txt in the home directory. Transport layer protection, this is the second part of encryption. This is about using SSL or TLS, as it's now called. Anywhere that you're doing login, anywhere that passwords are entered or changed, anywhere that credit card data is transferred, pretty much anything that requires authentication, we recommend you use SSL for. Because if you let people log in an SSL URL and then give them a cookie that goes over HTTP, then an attacker could sniff that on a Wi-Fi network or app poisoning or a whole bunch of different ways. If it's over HTTP, they could get that cookie. So if anything on your site requires SSL, put everything over SSL. And the old argument that the server's not fast enough and the certs are too expensive don't really apply these days. The other thing to remember is not to include HTTP resources. So Internet Explorer 5 or whatever it was used to give you that mixed content warning. The newer browsers don't. But if you've got a nice SSL website, but you're including Google Analytics over HTTP, then all an attacker needs to intercept is the JavaScript for Google Analytics, and they can put their own code in that. So make sure everything is HTTPS. And two specific things to do about SSL is SSL v2 is old, broken, and don't use it, but it's by default when you set up a new web server, it's enabled. And an attacker can downgrade a person's connection to SSL v2, potentially decrypt. And there's a bunch of weak ciphers that you need to turn off. That's more of a sysadmin kind of thing. They need to do that. Number next, which I think is 9... unvalidated redirects. This is really about making sure that your website doesn't allow people to be bounced off to a phishing site or an attacker's website. So the canonical example is you're on Facebook, you're looking at someone's pictures of their cats or whatever, and you go to a page that says, please re-log into Facebook, your session is timed out. you do it, and you're back on Facebook again. What actually happened was the attacker managed to get Facebook to redirect you to his server that looked like Facebook. He captured your username and password and sent you back none the wiser. So specifically, the things that we look for when we're doing reviews are redirects or server.transfers where user data could get in. The redirect URL on the login page, out of the box way of doing it, I think is okay, but often people don't use that. So if you're, you know, if someone tries to go to a protected site, you send them to the login page and then redirect them to the place they're trying to go to. Make sure you can't put google.com in that redirect. SharePoint has a similar class library. It's kind of SharePoint specific, which checks that the page that you're trying to send someone to is on the same domain and some other flags that you can set to restrict it to subsites, I think. So if you're a SharePoint dev, use that for redirecting people. Cool, number 11 of the OAuth top 10 is my bugbear, and that's because every security review I've done that involves a file upload where users can upload files has had a problem. So it's really easy to do a bad file upload system. And I've just put some HTTP headers that you should blat out every time someone downloads a file off your system. But there's a whole bunch of things you need to consider around file upload that we're not going to go into here because it's actually a talk on its own. But luckily I've done that already, and it's on our website. So if you've got anything where people can, you know, upload spreadsheets or PDFs or Word docs, please read that and consider those.
And I guess worst case scenario that we have seen several times is where, for instance, you can actually upload, say, ASPX pages to a .NET page or to a .NET website and they still execute. So in essence, it turns what was JavaScript attacks before into full server-side attacks. So you can now, the attacker can upload, say, through a video file upload or something that's been misconfigured, actually upload that ASPX to your site and then start running it. And if it's put together, so again, it might be that the uploaded file is saved in a location, but it's put together with some SQL injection, so we can modify where that uploaded file now lives, what it's called. So be very, very careful.
Yeah, file uploads are very easy to do that wrong.
Evil.
Cool, yeah, my talk with file uploads are evil, I think.
Yeah.
Cool, the last thing that we'll talk about before we talk about something else is trends that we're seeing at the moment. So things that browsers are now doing to help protect our websites. So one of them is this thing called content security policy. It's probably going to take a couple of years to really bed in the browsers, but Chrome and Firefox now support content security policy. Lucky that didn't come out as a bad word. So basically what the server can say is, these are the places where my CSS, where my JavaScript, where anything dodgy come from. I only want JavaScript to come from this server. And the browser will, when it's running your page, go, oh, some code on this web page is trying to load JavaScript from another server. Baff. And then a whole class of attacks stop.
Absolutely.
And even better, with content security policy, you can say, my web server, or the pages that I've set this header on, you're not allowed to put script tags in these pages. You can only do script source and equals from a file. And that means that a whole class of cross-site scripting, which is a script tag embedded in a page or an on-click handler or whatever, just go out. So really why I wanted to mention this quickly here is that if you're starting a new website today, now is the time to set a content security policy and architect your site in a way that you have no inline script tags. And if your site has no inline script tags, no on-clicks, no on-hovers, no on-whatevers, then in 2 years' time when mainstream browsers support this, you'll have the browsers stopping cross-site scripting on your site as well as all your own stuff that you do.
Absolutely.
There's a couple of other headers, one that stops clickjacking, which says my website can never go inside a frame. Another which says, hey, I'm an online banking website, and tells the browser, never contact me over HTTP, and the browser remembers that. So if you are an online banking website provider person, set that header, and then if someone gets phished or their traffic gets intercepted, your cookies can't be stolen, they can't be tricked. And it's kind of early days for this strict transport security header. At the moment in Chrome, there is a list of web servers that have contacted Chrome and said, never contact us over HTTP. If you want to be an early adopter, go and get your URL inserted into the Chrome source code. So it'll probably evolve to be something a bit more than that because you can't really fit every website inside the chrome.exe file, but at the moment that's how it works. And another really, it's not a new thing, but something that's happening a lot more is something called DOM-based XSS, which is where the XSS attacks are happening in the JavaScript that's running in the browser. So someone is putting something on the URL, putting a hash, and then a bit of content, which actually tricks JavaScript into doing cross-site scripting. The nasty thing about this is the server doesn't see the attack. It's all happening in the browser. So those are some things that it would be nice if you went away and read up more on and got ready for the momentum behind them.
What are you calling a moron?
Moron. So, speaking of moron,
there's the boss. What are you doing, man? Crazy man. So,
That's this, which we're going to give out. We've got a prize.
So we do. So we are currently exactly...
It's a webcam, so it's not as good as last year's prize.
No, last year was like a MSDN Universal, which people were like diving around breaking their ribs to get hold of.
Yeah, and all you can do on this one is chat roulette with your clothes off. So
exactly.
It's not quite as good.
Now, and we haven't put in any backdoors or hacks, so that in fact when you're playing naked roulette...
Factory seal.
That's right. Yeah, well... Factory reseal. So what we're going to do, right? So competition-wise, okay? So we're exactly 17 seconds over. So we have to have a speed competition. We decide in the world of hacking that the best way to get around security things is just honesty. So, in fact, the best way is just to hope that all your users are honest, hope that no one puts these things in. So from that side, we're going to do the same. We're going to ask some questions and hope that you're not lying.
Okay.
So we have a speed competition. So we're going to ask you a question. If you know the answer, stand up.
Okay, the person that gets a free life, stand up now.
And good man, free life. So look, first question. In fact, the first question is, who would like one of these?
Okay, stand up.
You've got to stand up. Which part of you got to stand up if you know the answer?
Cool.
Good. So it was an honesty thing. So what we're going to do is, if you're standing up, we might actually ask you, just to make sure you're telling the truth. Do you want this? See, he's telling the truth. We've got this so far.
Cool.
Okay, next.
He obviously has some chat roulette he needs to get done tonight.
Yeah, he's away for 3 days, man.
Sorry about that. Uh-huh.
Exactly. It,
okay. Okay, in your head, don't yell it out. What session number is this?
If you know the session number of this session, stay standing up. If you don't know the answer, sit down.
Okay.
Oh, 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 big filtration.
Cool,
no one's
okay.
Got a clue.
What was the command we used to...
I see,
to...
1, 2, 3, 4,
okay.
5. Yep.
Oh, there's 5, we'll do one more. If you know the command we use to encrypt the web config, stay standing.
Oh,
he's wavering.
Teetering.
Okay.
Okay, I'm going to ask you, because you're teetering. Is that going to make you stay standing up or sitting down? No, I'm not going to ask you at all. I'm saying if it's an honesty thing, it's under pressure.
Oh, he's under pressure. He's sweating. Okay, cool. Okay, the last one is...
He's good.
Okay, who is more handsome, me or Andy? If you know the answer, stay standing. Okay.
Oh, he sat down. He sat down. He doesn't know the answer, which is probably... If you don't know the answer, out of who is more handsome, then no, just sit down. That's terrible. Fail.
Okay. Cool. Okay, so the last one, just yell out if you know the answer. What was the cookie flag we set to stop it going over HTTP?
Oh, close. What was that?
Secure, or here's the...
Remember the one about it, so it's
require something. Okay, require SSL. I think it was the guy standing back there. So
good man.
Cool. So grab a copy of this on your way out, and thanks for coming.